Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, this is the Tripe Supper, our Borough podcast here at the Gazette, or Teesside Live. I'm Dom Shaw, the host. I'm joined by Phil Talentire and Chris Garbutt. And we're going to talk a few things today. Kits, the World Cup, transfers, obviously. Starting with kits, Borough have a new sponsor and they'll soon to have new kits. Hummel. Mm. I can't wait to see the kit. I've got a bit of Hummel clobber at home. In fact, I had my Hummel tracky bottoms on last night. I was buzzing when that was announced.
The chevrons are legendary, aren't they?
Yeah, you've got to look at some.
Yeah,
look at some kits.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of new kits haven't been revealed yet. I mean, Rangers have signed with Hummel, haven't they? And I thought you might get a clue from Rangers, but they haven't unveiled their new kit yet. It seems a lot of the models that I've seen so far have had the sort of the chevrons on the shoulders, and they look tight. I mean, the only one that I've seen that's particularly desperate was Fukushima United's third kit, which was like a salmon pink and orange.
That's a sentence we haven't heard.
No. Do you know what? I've been trying to get that. I've been trying to get hold of it and just sold out everywhere.
It would look good on you, Gav.
I mean, this was a Facebook Live, he rips off his
Yeah. I think Boca Juniors have signed up with Hummel, haven't they?
Yeah. I don't actually like their new one. I'm a big Boca Juniors kit fan. I like their colour coordinations. I think it's one of the world classic designs. But I'm not sure I like the one that Hummel's come up with them. It looks a bit messy and a bit over designed. But I think fans love new kits, don't they? I know there's the argument about cost and changing, you know, two kits every season, which is the thing now. Sometimes three with some clubs that have a third kit, but I do think by the end of a season you're kind of ready for a change, aren't you? And I thought Adidas did some good kits over the years. I thought they were much more consistent than, for example, the Array. I never really liked the Array's kits, and I think actually they've improved a lot since Borough haven't been getting their kits from Array. I think most of theirs haven't aged well, and some of them at the time were pretty desperate, in my opinion.
You're talking like late 90s technology there.
Yeah, I mean, you look at a lot of kits from that era. I mean, look at the famous Arsenal kit from the early 90s that was like yellow with like blue pyramids or whatever it was. I mean, it was horrific. Man United had one, didn't they, in the early 80s, an Adidas kit with all sorts of strange blue designs. And so the Borough weren't the only ones, but I do think Array never really matched the big companies, in my
view. Still a few great shirts.
The only thing I think that, you know, when I think about the Adidas ones is they're literally, you look around every Adidas club and they're just cut and paste out. Like, you know, all they've done basically is just put the badge over one of the others and the sponsor, and that's it.
I think the two I've liked have been more or less the last one. The last season's kit I thought was great. The plain white band on the red shirt, and I thought I quite like, even though I'm a big white band man and I believe it should stay for every kit, I thought the diagonal white band worked really well in the playoff sash,
wasn't it?
Yeah, I personally like that.
I think it looked a little unorthodox when it was tucked in.
Every had some belting kits.
Yeah, I was going to say,
my favourite was the green and dark green.
Few people said that.
Classic.
Unbelievable.
The promotion,
It was
in 94, 95.
I never liked, was it Jaden Hunter or something like that?
It was Dickens' sponsor.
Dickens.
But the colours were something like,
I remember seeing,
I had that home shirt still.
I think
with the transporter embedded in it.
I think that's one of the best kits they had, actually. Under Array. But for me, it just looked a little bit Manu-y. You know, I thought it was a nice, clean kit. It looked well designed. It looked neat on the players, but it didn't strike me as a Borough kit.
It's funny, isn't it, how shirts immediately make you think of a player.
Memories.
The blue and white, the light blue and white striped away shirt, Argentina-type shirt, that immediately makes me think of Gazza scored a free kick at Southampton.
Yeah,
I mean, John Motson.
I think of Rickard.
I think of Rickard with that black away shirt.
At Arsenal when they were
3-0.
That light blue, the light blue striped one, reminds me of Dean Gordon thundering on in Old Trafford.
I always remember going to buy a pair of boots from sports and soccer as it was back then, when it was in Cleveland Center, like on the corner where the Barclays Bank is now.
Yeah.
And I went in to buy a pair, and I was buying a pair of, you know, when they had like the fake Predators, so like the 40 quid version of the 120.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fella who was there is like, oh, Dean Gordon's been in this morning and bought four pairs. And I walked out thinking, Dean Gordon's got the same boots. I imagine that he'll have bought the real ones.
Yeah, the top
time.
Ones. I mean, the thing that gets me about the Borough kit, and you know, again, I do get on my high horse about things like kits, which is ridiculous. But I think that's what fans are like. They get upset about certain things that to outsiders seem ridiculous. But
yeah.
I think I'd like to see Borough adopt a proper away colours and stick to them.
Blue and black for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, that's one thing that's annoyed me over the years about Bury is that they've gone from like yellow shirts one season. But like sort of light blue and white stripes, as you've said, Gabs.
Yeah.
You could name any just about every colour under the book.
Well, like it should almost be like a uniform.
Well, I think some clubs over the years, I mean, you think of the '70s, Liverpool always had that yellow away kit, didn't they, for a while? And before that, it was like white shirts with black shorts. And Man United tended to wear white shirts with black shorts away from home. And like Leeds had an all yellow kit. Chelsea had an all yellow kit. I don't really care what colour it is. I prefer, as you said, Dom,
the black and blue
because it works well.
That reminds me of
because it looks smart. But I just don't know how you can go from like having a yellow shirt one season to getting to having black the next season, and it smacks of, I don't know. I like brand identity, and I think your club should have a bit of pride about what colours it wears.
Well, that's the argument takes you to the white band sort of topic of conversation, isn't it? Should that be a feature on every single Borough home shirt? I mean, I know that in sort of living memory time, it's been Borough's identity. But you go back to like before the '70s, and Borough never, you know, historically didn't always have a white band on the shirt.
They often had a white something on the shirt though. But back in the '30s, and I think you go back a long time now, but the team that did very well in the late '30s had like, I think, white shoulders, not white sleeves, but white shoulders that looked white. Mm. You know, look nice. So I think there have been slight designs away from a player, but there's just so many red shirts, isn't there?
Well, do you know the PR side of things that Hummel have put out alongside Middlesbrough since the deal was announced, and I think the tagline is, you know, the spirit of '86, isn't it? I hope it's like a throwback to that kit,
which was class.
There's a mint photo Mogger on one knee, ball under his arm, just with that kit on. It just looks class.
I've got high hopes for the Hummel training gear as well. Some of the tracky tops are really quality.
I had one in I didn't have a Middlesbrough one, but I had one in, I think I bought it in 1986. So I'm aging myself here drastically. I had a light, like a blue Hummel tracksuit with a white chevron sleeves. No, I wish I had.
Because we couldn't do that.
The other thing as well, I'm not likely to get into it, even if I did have it. But it was just a class design. I mean, obviously, that was their kind of era, the mid to late 80s, when they first broke through with Denmark. And then obviously, you had they went big in England after that, and they made some horrific kits as well as some real classics. Some of the kits in the early 90s, but as we've talked about, some real belters and some real ones you'd really want to forget about.
Any Borough horror shows, away kits, spring to mind?
I tell you what I thought was manky.
Manky, that's a good word.
Very, very manky kit. You know, the white, it was like
purple.
No, it was like, well, that was shocking.
Blue doxy.
Almost, it was like a white shirt, didn't fit any of the players at all, and it just looked like someone like spray painted blue down it,
and then across as well.
Well, you know when Borough scored that unbelievable goal.
That was a relegation season, wasn't it? 96-7.
Yeah, it was. When you know the goal, the ultimate passing team move at Old Trafford, when all the Man United fans started clapping, Janinho's goal.
Yeah.
That was in that.
Yeah.
And like Janinho looked, it looked literally seven times too big for him, that shirt.
I might be wrong here completely. Wasn't the badge on the back?
It was on the arm.
Oh, was it? I knew it was something different.
It had like Borough. Like, we're doing hand gestures here, by the way. So like
that white purple one.
It just looked so bad on players.
Horrific.
It was the wrong material. And it was bizarre how they had that sort of chest band. It was like a double band, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They had it one season for the home kit, but then they brought it, I can't remember which way around it was, and then they had it the following season for the away kit, or vice versa. I'm thinking, most clubs have the same design in the same season. They don't alter it.
Do you know, there was a season back in, obviously, maybe it was in the late 80s, early 90s, Borough was sponsored by ICI, and also we had our red shirt, but they did two, I don't know whether it was like a third kit, but they did two away shirts, and it was like, one was like white and one was blue, and it
in the 94-95 as well, they had the green and
yeah, that was
but then they had the blue, and
the blue and black was the start of the following season, wasn't it, after promotion, with the Warrior at Arsenal when
Bambi
was played. And I think that's when that came in, because I remember it standing, because it was a return to the blue and black.
You know, they do the retro shirts in the club shop.
They've got
them ones I'm on about, them blue and white ones in there. Like, the blue one's got like white speckles on it with ICI on it, and the light and the blue one's got white ones. Looks good. They're nice kits.
The yellow shirt from a couple of years ago, I remember being struck by, and I don't know whether it was because it's yellow and it's eye catching, but I remember being struck by at away games in particular how many fans.
Well, you know the penalty shootout at Old Trafford?
Yeah.
They wore it that night, didn't they?
Well, I think they had a pre-season at York. It might have been the day Alex Baptiste got injured.
Yeah, it was.
And behind the goal that day, there were so many in yellow. More in yellow than in red.
It goes back to getting a little 5% is in football. Surely it matters to an extent what your kit colour is in terms of just player identity on the. I think particularly some night matches, I think players can get lost in the background, and when you've got like a blue and black striped shirt, I'm sort of talking against my own argument here, but that surely doesn't stand out in the way that the yellow shirt you've just mentioned stands out. But I don't suppose companies worry too much about stuff like that. Although that famous time that Alex Ferguson made his Man United players change at half time because it was 3-0 down.
There's bright, and then there's that awful luminous yellow number that Man City had. I think it might have been around the days of Sean Good.
Yeah, when they got relegated.
That was a shocker.
I don't know whether you saw that. Obviously, you mentioned earlier about Hummel signing with Rangers. And they're releasing a third kit, and I don't think they've released the actual design, but they sort of did when they did the announcement, sort of teased the fans where they've put, we will be releasing a third kit, but Rangers badge and the Hummel badge is orange. So all their fans are now saying like, oh, is our third kit going to be orange? That's quite clever PR, that, isn't it?
To
get the fans talking.
And there's certainly a brand, I mean, I know they've been around the block for years and years, but there's certainly a brand back on the up, Hummel, aren't they?
Yeah.
I remember like a few years ago when New Balance started getting more and more kits. I think you'll know better than me, Phil. I think England Cricket, Liverpool, there were several kind of major moves New Balance made in a couple of years. And feels like Hummel are the same.
But it's weird, isn't it? How Adidas went through a phase of seeming to have nearly every club over the last few
Nike
years.
Nike have done it as well.
Nike have done it. And I do think they get it right more often. I agree with your point, Gavs, about a lot of teams have similar gear, particularly training gear. But I do think the big firms, I think they've got a little, they probably don't take quite as many risks as maybe a new company on the up does. And obviously Array, they were the new kids on the block, and that was a good deal for them, wasn't it? They made their names in this country on the back of Borough. A Borough team that was on the up.
You know, the Hill Street Centre is going to be stinking of Hummel leisure wear soon.
I'll tell you what, man, what we're on about, like, weird design. What was the idea behind those three quarter sleeves, one kit? Do you remember? There was
Boxich had that.
Was that the Carling Cup season?
I don't remember that.
They had a red kit, and had a couple of all red kits, and one of them was a particularly weird sleeve design that was deliberately extra long.
Do you know what? I don't know if I remember seeing boxes here. I don't know whether you used to roll it up.
See, I just thought he used to do that thing where you kind of roll and then let it ride over the top.
So put it up to your elbows so they get
the foliage.
It was just a joy to watch in any kit. Like,
when we were talking, when I was talking to Massimo Macaroni last week for that interview, talking about strikers, and I'd almost forgotten that there was a crossover between him and Boxic. There was a year, and it was a year when Boxic wasn't really doing much. You've got to think Macaroni obviously played with Aduga and Yakubu Hasselbank. And when I'd said, you know, who was the best you played with in a heartbeat, he said Boxic.
Incredible.
He pointed out, as every player does who played with him, when he was on his day.
That goes in brackets after Viduka and many other players as well, but particularly those Boxic was very much when he could be bothered, wasn't he?
I don't think you can be scared of saying that Boxic was world class on his day.
You know, it's World Cup coming up, and Boxic would have got into most, if not all, at his best of the squad for this summer's World Cup, wouldn't
he? He was, I would put him in the bracket, I don't think he had the work ethic or the commitment of Ibrahimovic, but equally that sort of big man ability to be just the boss of the pitch, that presence. Yeah. Like Viduka had it, Boxic had it. One or two players do have it.
World had a nice look of arrogance about.
Yeah, I think it must, you know, must help when you're 6'2", 6'3", 6'4", whatever he is, and you know you stand there and you like throw the shoulders out and the chin's up, isn't it? And it's, you think if he fancies it today, he can score as many goals as he wants.
He reminded me the way he held himself. Of Cantona,
shoulders back, chest out,
you knew he was on the pitch.
I remember going to Filbert Street and watching him pick the ball up on the halfway line.
Oh, I remember.
He ran forward about 10 yards and somehow chipped the keeper, and the keeper was on his line.
It was.
Do you remember that?
He was one of those players who you kind of thought he's going to have five. He has 5 minutes. It changes the game and then just switches off again.
What about chips, lobs, international football? Were you not at the Pavarsky game?
I was indeed, yeah. I was
Euro 96, you remember that guy?
Czech Republic.
Yeah, it was at Villa Park, I think. Portugal against Czech Republic, did you say?
He was Czech, wasn't he?
They got the final, didn't they? Yeah, because I remember that was it was a really hot night, sunshine, and it wasn't the greatest game, but I just remember Pavarsky. It was like a sort of a, like a, what do you call it, like a, he put his like a chip,
yeah, it was like a scoop, golf, a like, scoop,
yeah, like a golf,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
He almost like deaded the ball, didn't he? So it just lifted on its own momentum.
But if I remember rightly, he got some lucky knocks on the way through.
Yeah,
he beat a couple of men, but he got a couple of kind of lucky
ricochets. Sometimes get that new world, when players score a worldie, there's often a good little deflection that goes for them.
The two chips that spring to mind when you talk about that, I remember Cantona doing it against Sunderland when he didn't even celebrate, he just turned around.
Was it Lionel Perez in goal for Sunderland?
Yeah, and then Philippe Albert chipped Schmeichel for Newcastle.
Well, another in that Euro 96, I was near that. Suka, you remember Suka?
Davos Suka.
Yeah. He chipped Peter Schmeichel, which is always nice to see.
He could play, couldn't he?
I love talking about.
They were a great team, that generation, those Croatians. I mean, it's the Croatia's population. What is it? Something similar to Wales or something like that.
We could actually do a full podcast on classic 90s footballers, couldn't you? I haven't heard that Davos Suka name for about 10 years.
And you know, when you look back at former Borough back page, I remember when we did on this Borough Day on a daily basis, and it tended to be that if there was a player who was performing well in Europe or for his country at that point, Borough were linked with him.
Yeah, well, Borough were at one point. I mean, that was Brian Robson's ambition, wasn't it? He felt Borough could go for anybody, and Steve Gibson would back him. And I think there was a brief spell where Borough's financial clout, between say 96 and 98, it was a very small window, maybe it was 99, something like that, enabled them to go out and table bids, that would, is a good old cliche there, table bids for just about anybody, hence the reason that, you know, the sign Ravenelli on what was then was eye-watering wages.
Yeah.
But that only lasted a short period because the Sky money and then the big oligarchs came in, and before you knew it, Borough's time at the top table kind of ended.
Well, but Borough went out and signed Brazilian footballer of the year, Juninho, for
and nearly got Roberto
million.
Carlos, by the
but
way.
To go and do that in today's climate, it's like going to sign Neymar now, isn't it?
Yeah, they couldn't. I mean, the thing is, I think the difference is that in that climate then as well, there were players nobody had heard of.
Yeah,
you had at the market. I mean, nowadays every scouting network of a club of a certain size has just about every player in the world on their database.
Yeah.
So they'll know who the best player is at Sao Paulo and at Corinthians and Palmeiras and at somewhere in Venezuela. In those days, you could get ahead in the race.
Find
just by I mean Brian Robson spotted Juninho playing for against England, didn't he, at Wembley in 1995 in the Umbro Cup.
So on that, because Frank Lampard, obviously new Derby manager, is still going to the World Cup, isn't he, as a pundit. You know for a fact if Derby lose the first two or three games, there's going to be the finger pointing there.
What have you been doing all summer?
Yeah, but I mean, under McLaren and Robson, who were both assistants to Venables and then Sven, you know, their managers went away. And in numerous cases, it worked in their favour because McLaren approached Juninho the second time while they were away on international duty. So it can work both ways, can't it?
I do think it's like a... It's a double-edged sword, as you say. It's good in terms of the fact that you've got your coach, or manager indeed, in Robson's case, working with the best players in the country and watching his players playing against the best players in the world. So learning and obviously hopefully learning from the particular England manager at the time, whoever it was, as you say, Venables, or picking up tips. And Robson was a young manager on the way up anyway, wasn't he? Very inexperienced when he first went to Middlesbrough. McLaren slightly different in that he was already a very experienced coach when he came to Borough. But I also think it's a distraction. I do believe, you know, particularly the great example about Lampard, because the World Cup goes on in the middle of July, doesn't it? Mm. And presumably he'll be a pundit virtually till then. You know, but do you really want your manager? People say, well, you're only a phone call away, and I'm sure he'll be doing stuff in his room to keep in touch with his coaches and his team back at Derby. But really, I'd want to be on the ground, would you not? First management job at a new club where the pressure really is on to get results, as you say, Dom, immediately. I'd want him there. I'd want him in the office every day. I'd want him on the training ground with the players. I'd probably want the players to come back a bit sooner, well, so I could get to know them quickly.
Even if, you know, like you mentioned early on, that the players come back first week in July, the window shuts in beginning of August.
You've
got 5 weeks to assess his squad. So what you'd hope really is that, you know, he needs to learn very, very quickly. He doesn't know anybody in the squad. You'd hope that he wouldn't be going to the World Cup and he'd be spending the next 5-6 weeks before the players come back watching every game of last season. And, you know,
which I'm sure he will be.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean,
he's going to struggle to do that while he's
still he's got the sense of being doing that for the last week and for the next week or two before he goes off to Russia.
But Tony Pulis does have a slight advantage, does he not? In that when you look at the teams who you'd probably expect on paper to be in and around them, Swansea new manager Graham Potter's not yet confirmed, or isn't at the time of recording here. Darren Moore, who's in, but obviously, yeah, he was in charge, obviously, he knows the players. Well, anyway, Gary Rowett at Stoke, Frank Lampard at Derby. Yeah. Like you say, you know, if they get the players back last week of June, say, six weeks, to assess what they've got, decide what they want, look to ship a couple out, and then make stuff happen. Mm. You know, for Pulis to have said after that Villa game, I know what's needed, it's a good head start for Borough.
Well, and the clubs that you've mentioned there are all the top 3, 4, 5 fancy teams. Stoke, I think Stoke are favourites, West Brom second, Borough third favourites for promotion. So, you know, all of them clubs have got a lot to adjust, you know, a lot of adjustments to make, haven't they? Maybe not Darren Moore, but, you know, they've got to go in and very quickly get to know their squad and get to know who they want and who they don't. Whereas Pulis is, you know, hopefully been spending the last 2, 3, 4 months doing that, you know. So yeah, Borough have got a head start. They need to make that camp come the beginning of August, because you need to hit the ground running.
I just think if I was Frank Lampard, I think I wouldn't have my head in the World Cup. I'd have my head on.
That's what I mean.
I just, you know, it's like I don't know. I can't think of an example. It's like starting a new job in any environment, you know, but you can't really get on with it because you're sidetracked doing something else. Yeah. If you've got an exciting new challenge like he's got, surely he should have just said, look, you know, I can't come to the World Cup. I've taken on this big job. It's a big commitment. It's a huge, it's a big club derby, in the way that we'd be disappointed. I think if it was us sat here now, you know, let's say, you know, Tony Pulis decided to leave at the end of the season and Borough appointed Frank Lampard, I think we'd all be a little bit disappointed that he wasn't going to be walking back through the doors at Rockcliffe till. I mean, he might have a clause in his contract where he goes after the knockout, before the knockout rounds. I don't know.
I'm sure he must.
He must have. Because,
well, he won't be still July 15th. That's only 3 weeks before the season starts.
Yeah, I mean, the Borough players are due back on, what, the 26th or 27th, the first day of that week, whatever that happens. And that's only a couple of weeks away now. So you know, Tony Pulis, next season's really already starting.
I think the season starts 23 days after the World Cup finishes.
Yeah,
our season.
I mean, I think obviously the World Cup won't affect us greatly, but I mean, the World Cup will go right into the middle of July.
15th of July.
Which, you know, I think the last World Cup finished I think something like the 1st or 2nd of July, you know, early on in July anyway. So there was a little bit of a pause. But
maybe he's got contractual commitments, you know, maybe he can't back out. I don't know. Yeah. I mean,
he might argue that I'm looking at players.
He might do it as a scouting mission.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know Ron Atkinson went to one major tournament when I think he was at Villa off the top of my head years ago, and they started the following season badly, I think. And suddenly you've got that accusation that you didn't have your head in the game.
Mm. Well, he said, didn't he, Lampard, because he'd been pictured at the League Two playoff final, and in his unveiling, he'd said, someone had said to him, you were spotted at the League Two playoff final, is that the type of player you're looking for? He said, well, I'm going to be a pundit at the World Cup, but I'm not targeting Lionel Messi.
I think he's got a bit about him, actually, lad.
I think he's excellent.
Yeah, I think he's good. I think what's pleasing as well is we've seen a couple of high profile former England players, Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard, go into management, and the worry was, or has been,
you take quite tough jobs.
Also, the good, talented, experienced English footballers weren't going into management because it was seen as too much hassle. So you saw, for example, Rio Ferdinand's a pundit, isn't he, doing well? Gary Lineker's been a pundit for years. Jamie Redknapp. You know, are we losing something? Because these players are retiring and they don't need the money. And more importantly, they don't need the grief.
Well, I think it was Gary Neville. I mean, I know Gary Neville, it didn't work for him at Valencia. But when you watch him,
he's got a good football brain.
I think he's streets ahead of anyone. I think Shuley, with all that knowledge, and he puts it across well as well. Mm. I think Shuley,
it was a strange appointment.
It was a bad move all day long. Yeah.
But he said, didn't he, I couldn't look myself in the mirror and take myself seriously if I turned down the offer of going to manage a club.
It wasn't as bad as where did Tony Adams go when that famous clip of him? He showed them how to come out. it just really work in this forum, but like spinning forward for a yard and coming back for a yard. And not being able to speak the lingo and just looking people and throwing your arms off. It doesn't work with waiters and it doesn't work with footballers, does it, when you're abroad?
The early deadline this summer, is that a good thing or a bad thing for Borough and Tony Pulis?
Well, in the case of getting a head start on some of your rivals, then maybe a good thing. You know, I would imagine that as soon as the final whistle went at Villa Park, 20 minutes later, Tony Pulis had a microphone in front of him and he said, I know what I need, I know what's necessary. So, you know, I would like to think that the ball is in motion, the wheels are turning with regards to that, whereas, you know, some other clubs may not be in that fortunate situation. So I think it's good also for the fact that when the season does start and everybody's got in the mind that, like, there's another month before the window shuts, it's almost as if, like, the first three or four games of the season aren't real, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? Where it's like, it's a feeling like, well, Do I want to cheer this player on? You know, is this player going to be here in 3 weeks' time? I think it's good that it shuts sharpish after, is it 3-4 days after the first game?
Yeah. So Harry Redknapp last year, for example, at Birmingham, I remember in the first 2-4 games, the results weren't going to plan for them.
Yeah.
And he kept saying, when I get my squad together, we'll be in the mix. When I get my squad together, we'll be in the mix. And then he probably realised 6 weeks later, you know, I'm not getting
there's a lot
this
of football.
Squad I wanted. It offers clarity, doesn't it?
A lot of football in August, and there's a lot of important games. I mean, I remember you could make the argument that Borough probably missed out on automatic promotion in 2014-15 because of the bad start they made. Was that the season beaten home by Reading?
Reading and Sheffield Wednesday.
Well, I think it was that season, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think Voss and Wilshut came in later in the window. And you could put part of that down to the fact that Aitor didn't have his squad. You know, Bamford came in after the start of the season as well. So I think the only worry is, and I don't think it's going to be a problem here at Borough, but there is the worry that you can still sell. And I can imagine some chairman at clubs where they've got a real hot asset, and
stupid money
gets offered and you end up selling your best asset and thinking, well, we'll pick up a replacement in January because the money's just too good to be true. Now that could happen, and so there's that possibility, but I mean it's just so tedious, isn't it, the window going, you know, it's like you say, you know, you're playing, you know, nowadays August is a month of football before the first international break, and the vast majority of that time is spent wondering whether you're going to lose your best midfielder or whether you can sign a centre back or whether you can, you know, whether the manager's going to get any money. Yeah. It's crazy, really.
Do you know what?
Sorry, Gabs, go on.
Yeah, so you're talking there about like the season starting off. We're all like looking forward to it. Like the World Cup hasn't even started yet, right? And I'm already dreading the first international window. Like when you said that, like August kicks off, you only play like four games, don't you?
Like, and then
you're
like, there's the two start.
That is a horrendous international break.
Come close back to back, don't they?
Yeah. Anyway, roll on next week.
Just finally, it favours the players as well, doesn't it? That they get that bit more clarity, because I don't think it favours anyone, does it, when players are starting for clubs and they've had the heads turned. Mm. They probably know they're going to go. This kind of auction's rumbling on in the background.
You know, we spoke about how, the uncertainty of players maybe not knowing what they're going to do and whatnot. But I mean, for argument's sake, Martin Braithwaite now, this is an opportunity for him to you know, if he doesn't want to be at Borough next year, maybe he does, maybe he doesn't, I don't know, but if he goes and rips the World Cup up in you know, in over the next 4 weeks, does he then become a majorly sellable asset for Borough?
Well, the thing is, if he rips the World Cup, I mean, maybe he's an asset that Borough shouldn't be overlooking in terms of for their own.
Mm.
You know, it's interesting what you're saying. You know, Tony did say, didn't he, as Dom, you just repeated there, that he said, I know exactly what I want. And has he really assessed all of, had time to really assess all of the players as close as he, you know, would really want to? And then a lot of them, yes, but I mean, quite a few of them went out in January. He sold a couple. You know, I'm sure he's got a good idea about 80% of the squad, but there must be players there he wants to spend. I mean, surely he wants, again, the World Cup won't help in this, but I'm surely he would want a pre-season with Braithwaite. He's not
for me, though, the suggestion was that it was Braithwaite who was keen on the move.
Peele's
idea is, well, if he doesn't want to be,
I get that and I understand that, but I kind of think, well, you've got an asset there who cost the best part of £9 million or whatever it was. Maybe both of them could, having 3 or 4 weeks of intensive training,
could
learn more about each other. He could have a job to do. I don't know. I mean, obviously the manager has to decide who he wants and who he doesn't want. He stands or falls by his decisions. But it's quite. I mean, how long had Braithwaite been at the club when Peele's been at the club when Braithwaite left? Was it a month? Pretty much, back end of the window. So he'd only really had four weeks.
Started what, one game, the first home game.
Yeah.
And he's never really played in his strongest. He's rarely played in his strongest position at Borough. Yeah. So perhaps you can understand why he was a little bit frustrated. And you're right. We don't know what's gone on behind the scenes. There might have been words. They might have failed to, you know, come to an understanding on his best position. You don't know what's gone on. So it may be that Braithwaite's been the architect of his own downfall. But
to what extent do you think that Pulis will have a scouting eye on the World Cup, or do you think Borough will have a team out there?
I think he'll already have ideas as to who he wants in each department. Yeah. I think it's one of those where if an opportunity arises after the World Cup with a certain player, then obviously you look at it. But I don't think, for example, for 1 minute, Pulis or any other Championship manager will think, I want a left-sided midfielder, for example. I'll see what's on.
I'm going to go and see. Yeah.
I think it's a really bad place to make an audition as well, a World Cup, because I mean, how many times have we seen players have great World Cups and come into? I mean, I think of Romania after the '94 World Cup, where they had four or five players who looked absolute world beaters. Mm. You know, you had Radichoyu, for example, came. I think he went to West Ham and he just didn't settle. You know, Poborski didn't really do it when he came to Man United. Jordi Cruyff again went to Man United. He didn't really look the part. I mean, I think managers don't really do that anymore. But there was a spell, certainly in the '90s, particularly, I think, and then the early 2000s.
Well, Liverpool signed Salif Diao on the back of that.
It does happen.
I think managers are less likely to use it as a guide to who's a great player. Yeah. You know, you see somebody having a great couple of games in a World Cup and get signed in a blaze of glory, and by the end of October they've played three games, they're unsettled. That they're not used to, I don't think it happens as much now, but they struggle.
I think the thing as well is so often now you hear managers talking about how they sign more than the player, and you know that they find out what he's like. I can't remember, was it Liverpool? I can't remember the club that kind of go and watch players in their everyday lives, almost stalk them to kind of find out what their routine is during the day, what they do when they're not playing football, and if you're signing someone, you know, a week after he's impressed in two or three games, you don't get the unless he's been on your radar and you've gone over almost just to justify to back up your view, then you're not getting that view, are you?
No. I mean, a couple of examples that spring to mind for me is Real Madrid spending
James
70, 80 million on James Rodriguez, who, you know, I'd be a lying man to say I'd even heard of him before that World Cup. I swear, I'd never even heard of him. And another one is, you know, if you did sort of only judge it on tournament performances, then Hal Robson-Kanu would have been playing for Real Madrid, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
You know, like, It was incredible, wasn't it?
Sam Vokes would have been Lewandowski's replacement.
Don't get me started on Wales getting the semi-finals, please.
Just finally, because this was
Wales,
the
Wales
last...
or Bills.
This will be the last tripe, I think, before England play the first game. So we'll go with some predictions. England, what do we reckon?
We'll get another one next week, won't we?
Yeah, like squeeze one in next week. But we're
did you mean for the big game against Costa Rica? No?
What do we reckon?
I'll be drastically disappointed if England don't get out of the group. Tunisia, okay, you know, they might be tough, they might make it difficult for England, but we should be beating Tunisia and Panama. It then comes down to shootout against Belgium, doesn't it? I think it'll be a 1-2 Belgium England or England Belgium either way. And then you go from there, but yeah, I think England should get out of the group.
I think England should win the first match, and I think the problem is if they don't, it puts huge pressure on for the remaining two games, and I think that's why Southgate will be desperate to get any sort of win to get the campaign up and running. And they should win, they should be beating, as you say, they should be beating Tunisia. There's some talented young players in that England team, and I don't really get the argument that they haven't been there and done it, because if people were saying that about Germany a few years ago, you know, before they played England in 2010, yeah, that new generation of German players, well, every player has to be an unknown before he becomes a known, and then he becomes a superstar. So often you worry about what players have done. It's maybe it's nice for a new group of players to make their own history.
Do you think that this squad, I mean, they really are going there with, you know, they say about the pressure of performing for England in big tournaments and so on and so forth. Surely they can't have that weight of expectancy on their shoulders, because there's nothing coming from the nation expectancy-wise.
I never really quite get that.
The froze against Iceland.
I don't get me wrong. I think that all comes down to just bad management. The players didn't know what their job roles were. They didn't know what the tactical plan was. It was clear they didn't have a plan B. I think crucially,
I thought it was a case of shirking responsibility.
Yeah. Iceland.
But I think what you're saying is that those players have been in big matches this season. Yeah. You know, those players, these aren't players who are just, you know, taking it easy. They've played in some high octane games. You know, you've got Henderson, who's just come back from the Champions League final. Mm-hmm. You've got players in that Dele Alli, who's put, you know, big high profile games that would have Champions League finishes riding on them. Right through that team, there are players, you know, Kyle Walker, Man City. They're no pressure. I think the difference is it's a different type of pressure, because you haven't got that one or two players in the team who can get you out of trouble. So Liverpool would be Mo Salah, for example. Man City have got four or five match winners, haven't they? I think that's the difference. Is it when the pressure's come on them to deliver? So it's going to be a big tournament for Harry Kane, I think. He could come out of that potentially a world star.
Yeah.
And he's got the attributes, but he also could come out of it as the latest England player to flop at a big tournament. So
there's obviously the Gareth Southgate link, which we should have probably talked about. Probably gives us an idea for next week. Yeah, Phil, you haven't worked closely with him when he was in charge at Borough. So yeah, thanks for that. Cheers, Gabs. Cheers, Phil.